Marty Moscoen, welcome back to Radio Times. A regional director of the National Labor Relations Board ruled recently that players on Northwestern University's football team are employees of the university and as such have the right to unionize. That decision quickly reverberated across campuses, especially where sports are a big deal. The director pointed to the revenue that Northwestern gets from football and the many hours that the athletes are required to devote to the sport, as many as 50 to 60 hours a week. Well, this ruling raises a host of questions about student athletes, about the NCAA, and the place of sports in higher education, our topic for this hour of Radio Times. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Karen Weaver. She's an associate clinical professor of sports management at Drexel University, also a lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania. Karen Weaver, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be with you.
And joining us by telephone is Amy Perko. She's the executive director of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. And Amy Perko, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be with you and Karen.
And I know you two know each other. Amy, let me begin with you. What do you make of this decision? What was your initial reaction when it was made?
Well, I think that this decision could be a potential watershed moment for college sports. It's an important decision, and it certainly does bring immediate ramifications, not just to Northwestern and the football players at Northwestern, but could have potential far-reaching effects immediately on other private institutions, since it does apply to private institutions. And certainly now many questions are surfacing in terms of what this means and what it means for the athletes and what it means for other potential universities that would fall under the same parameters of the judge's of the regional director's decision.
Do you agree that these football players are employees of Northwestern University? Do you agree with that part, that decision?
Well, in terms of the Knight Commission's reaction to the decision, the Knight Commission actually supports many of the benefits being sought for college athletes by groups like the College Athletes Players Association, which organized the union efforts by the Northwestern football players. Benefits like providing multi-year scholarships, covering medical expenses for athletic injuries, and certainly providing funding for former athletes to complete their education. You know, in fact, many universities do these things now.
Right.
But the commission believes that colleges and the NCAA, not unions, need to be the ones to guarantee those types of benefits and make the changes that are necessary to improve the educational experience of college athletes. The commission, Knight Commission, has worked for more than 20 years, and recently in a 2010 report made a number of recommendations that it felt colleges needed to make and the NCAA needed to make to really reset college sports and bring about more accountability and get back to the core mission. And one of the fundamental recommendations of that report was to treat athletes as students first, not as professionals. And that principle really is at the core of this decision, because the regional director found that given the number of hours, given the number of other conditions, that athletes were employees. And there are a number of changes that, again, the commission hopes that colleges and universities will now adopt, given this additional pressure. And one of those was that we talked about in 2010 in our report. We really need to reduce the amount of time athletes are required to spend on their sports.
Well,
they need to have more time to be students.
Well, let me pick up on that, because and going to you, Karen Weaver, at least at Northwestern University, these athletes expected to spend something like 50 to 60 hours either preparing for a game or going to a game or playing on a field.
Yeah, one of the things that this ruling really addressed was this issue of control over their lives. And what the NLRB discovered was that the fact that the coaching staff has enormous control over their lives, from where they live to what car they drive, to when they can eat, how much they should or should not eat, and also how many hours are expected to be involved in team activities, whether it be film or lifting. And so at certain times in the year, it is 50 to 60 hours a week, which is far more than what they're engaging in their academic studies.
Well, I mean, can you call someone that works 50 to 60 hours a week on a sport a student athlete?
Well, it would seem that if they're on the same par, that would be they're devoting the same amount of energy. And even at an elite academic school like Northwestern, you're still finding that they're devoting far more hours to sport.
But is it – money in the final analysis. The finding was that Northwestern was making, I think, 1 year or over a period of time, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars
off
of football.
In fact, the NLRB found out that Northwestern over a period of 2003 to 2012 generated $235 million from their football program and used those funds to subsidize the non-revenue sports as well as the ability for the institution to stay in compliance with Title IX. So those funds were served a very valuable purpose for the institution, which in NLRB's position made them even closer to employees.
So do you think they should be allowed to unionize and bargain collectively?
I think the word union is an inflammatory term. I think what, and I concur completely with the Knight Commission on this, there are a lot of health and safety issues that really need to be addressed by the NCAA that we know more now than we've ever known before about concussions and long-term injuries at these players, and not just football, but other sports as well. And so we have a moral obligation to talk about that in a way that's a little less patronizing in a more substantive way.
One of the arguments, Amy, go ahead. Let me just toss this out here. One of the arguments is that these players, they get scholarships, and in a sense, that's how we quote unquote pay them.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that is something that is one of the questions that you know is now coming up in terms of what are the implications, because now the $40,000 to $50,000 scholarship a player may receive to attend a private university is now taxable, and those are the types of implications that players are going to have to consider when they cast their vote whether or not to be represented by a union. But going back to some of the central issues that the athletes have talked about is they want to have a greater voice, in the decision-making about policies. And that issue runs to one of the recommendations the commission made to the NCAA just last year. The commission provided a number of recommendations to improve the overall governance of the NCAA, and the commission felt that outside directors who will have the best interest of college sports in mind, the best interest of the players, needed to be added to the board of directors that right now is exclusively university presidents who are representing their conferences. And many times those decisions get tied up in the financial and competitive interest of the conferences and the institutions. So the commission recommended that former athletes be added to the board as outside directors, and that still is a change that we continue to urge the leaders to consider as they are considering a new framework for governance and how best to construct the governance moving forward so that all the interests are considered.
Well, I'm picking up on that and going back to you, Karen. I mean, does this raise questions about the NCAA and what they do and don't do? And are they just a money-making machine?
Well, there are some pundits who would argue that that's what it is. And the organization is under attack from a lot of different areas. But I will say this, and this is a fair statement, and they will agree with it. The NCAA is us. I mean, it's member institutions who are making these decisions. So that's why what the Knight Commission is proposing with regarding to having outside directors have a voice at this allows people to independently assess whether this is the right thing or the best thing, rather than lobbying at it from the perspective of what's best for me and my conference.
I think this is correct. Last year, the NCAA made $1.15 billion.
From their television contract,
mostly. From the television
mostly.
Contract.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and it's distributed in a rather interesting formula to different schools, depending on their postseason performances and their conference allotments and that. So it's a lot of money.
An interesting formula. What does that mean, an interesting formula? That's such a wishy-washy word. Yeah, go ahead.
Can I jump in on that, Marty?
Go ahead, Amy.
Because a lot of the criticism, as Karen pointed out, has been around, whether the NCAA is an organization that prioritizes generating revenues or does it prioritize providing educational outcomes and an quality educational experience for those athletes through sports. And it's the latter that we believe the focus needs to be, providing that educational and developmental experience through sports. That is the reason it exists. And it's gotten away from that core mission by putting too much focus on generating the revenues. And that's our criticism as well as the conferences, And we've made two recommendations that run directly to the financial issues. And one is there needs to be much greater transparency about where the money goes in college sports. And unfortunately, the NCAA has not acted on one of the commission's recommendations that would require public disclosure of every institution's NCAA financial report that really just provides that type of public awareness and that disclosure about where this money is going. The commission did create its own database that shows a lot of information about athletics and academic spending at 220 public institutions in Division I, and that database is spendingdatabase.knightcommission.org, and then it exists, again, to improve the public accountability for the money coming into college sports. The other recommendation is that the financial rewards teams are playing for must change. Karen mentioned the formula. Just to give you an example, the teams that won games in this year's March Madness tournament earned their conferences more than $1 billion.
Wow.
That those conferences will receive over the next 6 years. And the commission believes that's just a ridiculous amount for winning for an association that claims education as its number one priority. And those increasing financial stakes for winning certainly help coaches receive lucrative postseason bonuses, but they do nothing to enhance the educational experiences of athletes. So again, there are better ways to divide those types of revenues and the coming $500 million annually that will come in through the college football playoff. And there needs to be a real focus on how those new revenues will be used, and it needs to be used to strengthen the educational mission, not to continue to pump up an entertainment product that is separating itself from the universities.
About a minute before our first break here. So, Karen, if we're talking about a student-athlete, let's say a student-athlete football player, what does that look like?
Well, it's pretty much your job, and in many situations it is what your life looks like. I mean, you go to school and you play football, and those are the two things that you do, and your coaches have a lot of control over that experience for you, and you want to satisfy the coaches. That's why you're there. And until recently, you've had a one-year annually renewable grant and aid. Now some football programs are making them four-year or five-year. But still, you had to perform, and that was what was utmost on the student-athlete's mind, which can weigh on it pretty heavily.
Well, and how about the graduation rate? I mean, it seems to me that if a college or university recruits a student-athlete, they have a certain responsibility to help them do the academics.
They do, and the NCAA has been very forthright, as has the Knight Commission, about that. The one nuance with all of that is the fact that the student-athletes, some of them would argue they're not getting to choose the majors they want because of the conflicts of the classes with the practices.
I'm going to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Karen Weaver. She's an associate clinical professor of sports management at Drexel University. Amy Perko on the telephone is the executive director of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. And we're talking about the decision just last month, an official from a regional national relations board ruling that football players at Northwestern University were employees and could unionize. We'll be right back.
Touchstone Center for Crafts supports WHYY, a residential craft school located in Farmington, Pennsylvania, 4.5 hours from Philadelphia in the Laurel Highlands. Offering weekend and week-long workshops in a variety of traditional and emerging craft forms, including blacksmithing, ceramics, and jewelry arts on its 150-acre woodland campus. Touchstone Center for Crafts, the natural setting for your creative nature. Information at 1-800-721-0177.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a new film tells the story of Eric Lomax, a British soldier tortured by the Japanese during World War II.
My husband isn't coping.
War leaves a mark, Mrs. Lomax.
We'll meet the real-life Mrs. Lomax next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Arts and Business Council of Greater Philadelphia supports WHYY and will host Arianna Huffington on the morning of April 1st. Huffington will discuss how she's redefined success beyond money and power in her new book, Thrive. More at artsandbusinessphila.org.
Supporting WHYY, the 2014 Lincoln MKZ with standard Lincoln Drive Control, offering normal, comfort, and sport driving modes.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Karen Weaver and Amy Perko about a decision came from the Chicago office of the National Labor Relations Board, ruling that football players at Northwestern University were university employees and they could unionize and bargain collectively, a decision that has been both hailed and criticized and raised a whole host of questions about student athletes and sports revenue. Our conversation in this hour of Radio Times, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cowain. Karen, going back to you, just only because we were talking about this during the break, so that at some schools or even at Northwestern, there was a student that wanted to take a chemistry class, but that interfered with practice.
Yeah, King Coulter, who's the quarterback who initiated, has been the public face of this, is listed in the agreement as saying, I wanted to take a chemistry class during the season, and because my practices were in the morning, I was discouraged from taking it, and I was asked to take it during the summer. That put me one full year behind my class, and he eventually changed his major to psychology.
But do you think that the colleges, universities, where sports is a moneymaker, the way it is at Northwestern, do you think they really will sort of rethink how they treat their student athletes?
Well, one of the things I think is the unintended consequences of this is there will be a closer look at the analysis between the practice schedules and the academic schedules, and trying to look at where the student athletes want to be. Because I think it's hard to say I'm going to Northwestern because they have a great medical school and end up with a psychology degree or a communications degree or something you don't want to practice when you're done. I think that's the true intrinsic value of getting an education at a school like that.
What do you think, Amy? Then we'll get to our callers.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And to Northwestern's credit, you know, Northwestern has had the highest graduation rate among football teams of all the teams competing in the FBS. So it's actually very interesting that this case is happening at Northwestern, because they would, as they have said, they certainly are not a football factory, and they have, as I said, just exemplary graduation rates among their football team and all their athletes. You know, and this is related to this issue of the educational focus. One of the commission's recommendations and one of the things that is certainly talked about here is using some of these revenues coming in, setting them aside, to allow athletes, former athletes, to come back and continue their education, perhaps get a second undergraduate degree, perhaps get career development, continuing education. And those are the types of things that where the money should be used and should be available to athletes for that purpose. And so that's an example of a concept and an idea that needs to be expanded and needs to really be prioritized by university leaders with these new revenues that are coming into the system.
Let me get Claire from Swarthmore to join our conversation. Hi, Claire. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi everybody. I just wanted to add a little piece of information. My daughter is a varsity athlete at Northwestern in one of the low-revenue sports. It's one of the all-women sports they have there. And they held a meeting for the team last night just to talk about this unionizing issue. And I was very disappointed in the kinds of things that my daughter reported to me that were said at the meeting. Things like, unions lie in court, unions are just there to give money to political parties. They were discouraging the students from going to the voting site. And basically, they said in a very straightforward way, if the football team unionizes, we're going to have to cut your sport. And it was distressingly negative. My daughter's really benefited from being an athlete there, but it's just disappointing.
And Claire, who was the they? Is it the coaches? Was it members of the administration? Who was talking to the students?
You know what? It's a great question. I honestly don't know. The coaches were there, and I don't know whether somebody more senior was there.
Let me give Karen Weaver a chance to weigh in on that.
Well, Claire, that's disappointing to hear. Certainly, I know that the university, Northwestern University, did ask its legal counsel exactly what the coaches were allowed to say to the players. And I would think that the NLRB would have some concerns about that kind of content if, in fact, that's what was said, because it is supposed to be an open vote. Along those same lines, I am concerned about the fact that now media folks are tracking down each member of the Northwestern football team that's eligible to vote, trying to secure their vote on the record to see how the vote might go on April 25th, and that concerns me as well.
Oh, just the kind of pressure that these students are feeling. Your thoughts, Amy?
Well, I think, again, this decision, as I said, could have far-reaching implications, and I think that, you know, currently all private universities are really on notice, and a number of those universities are actively beginning to, you know, train their staff about what's permitted to be said along these lines with regard to any union organizing that may occur on behalf of its athletes. So I think it's something that all university leaders right now, particularly in private universities, have to be aware of. I think the overarching issue from the commission's perspective is it's really disappointing that we are at this stage. We've said all along university presidents and conference commissioners in particular have had the power to change the course for college sports, and unfortunately, the changes that are coming may be a little bit too late, maybe too little too late, to really get us back on course, and we may be at a point where the courts and others dictate the model for the future. I hope that's not the case. I hope we can still turn the ship in the right direction, but we're not at a good place to do that.
Claire, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Alex from media has to say. Alex, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a little concerned by the emphasis on the amount of money the football team made for the college, and people keep mentioning this over and over as if it's a justification for the union and a reason for the union. There are many, many people who participate in sports that are much less popular and don't bring in as much money as football teams do, and whose coaches, I'm thinking of my husband, when we were in college, he was on a team that was much less popular, but he was on the same amount of pressure and under the same amount of control as the football players. He worked 40 to 60 hours a week. He was under constant pressure to win and to practice for hour after, hour after hour. And his coach controlled his diet, his social life, everything. He was also forced to go to a meet one time when he had a fever of 104. He was immensely ill. And the coach told him that he was going to lose his scholarship if he didn't get out of bed and he should just meet immediately, which he did. And he made it through the day barely upright and actually did well, but that's beside the point. Still, he felt that he had to go to this meet,
right,
as ill as he was. And I think people who don't see it or don't have family members in these sports don't understand the amount of control that the coaches have over the players. They control their lives. It is everything. It is much more important than the academics, and it's more important than anything else. Social, everything else has nothing. It's meaningless.
Well,
it's
Alex, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and only because Karen's nodding her head, and I'm going to toss that over to you, and you work at a university.
I do, and I think it's one of the things, as a former coach, I was acutely aware of the pressure to be as competitive as the football team was, particularly if you were at an institution where the football team was high profile, and you do see what they're doing, and many times coaches' associations lobby for rules changes that allow the same kind of control that they see football and men's basketball primarily have over their players. So I can absolutely relate to what Alex is saying.
And that's
Can I jump in on that?
Yes, Amy,
well?
Go ahead.
Because I think I've heard this speculation, and some attorneys have, you know, said this decision is not just about the amount of money the football team brings in and kind of the four-part employee test that was used by the regional director certainly could apply to other sports that don't bring in net proceeds, net positive revenues. And it goes back to, again, this core mission is why do sports exist and on our university campuses? And we believe they exist to provide an educational and developmental experience for those participants. And we've got to do a better job of setting the expectations and training coaches for their role as educators. And it's not just about winning at all costs. It's about providing an experience that does contribute in a positive way to the education and development of college athletes. And in some cases, we're doing a better job of training youth coaches in some sports than we are with college coaches in terms of the expectations and some of the training that's developed. And that's another area where you look at the revenues coming into college sports. Some should be put into that area as well to make sure that coaches see themselves as part of the education and development role and not are just there to win.
That's Amy Perko. She's the executive director of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. Karen Weaver also was with us as well, an associate clinical professor of sports management at Drexel University. We are talking about the decision, a member of the National Labor Relations Board ruling recently that players at Northwestern University's football team on the team are employees of the university and have the right to unionize and to bargain collectively. And again, it's an issue that has implications for all sorts of campus-related issues, including sports and student athletes and the NCAA and more. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss. Coang, what do you think of the idea of football players unionizing? Let me ask you, Karen, something that I know the NCAA does not let players, I guess, make money on the side if they're getting a scholarship. But also that they can use their likenesses, they can use their names to make money, but the player cannot.
Right, and that's, of course, what's at the core of this NCAA versus Ed O'Bannon and other athletes, and that case is scheduled to be heard in June, not too long from now.
Right.
But I think one of the things that the College Athletes Players Association is advocating for is the right for players to be entrepreneurial. And you see so many students on campuses now that are being encouraged to start their own businesses, encouraged to really try their business skills on, and student athletes are being withheld from that by being able to use. There was a wrestler at Minnesota who was an excellent rap artist, and because he was somehow linked with the wrestling team, he was not permitted to continue his rap career, which had nothing to do with him being a wrestler, right, but because he was earning money. So I think these athletes oftentimes have more restrictions on them than the typical student.
Should those restrictions be lifted, Amy?
Well, the restrictions haven't been lifted currently. There are some complicated issues. I think they're looking at ways in which to do that. The commission's concern over time has been, you know, just that, and the commission actually was against and really a lone voice in the wilderness on this issue many years back when there was a move to use athletes more and more in video games and other types of commercial products and using those likenesses. And our point was, you know, as amateurs under the NCAA rules, they cannot benefit individually from that. So third parties in the NCAA should not be using their likenesses in that way. And to draw the line, to draw a hard line over the use of their images for those purposes. But, you know, certainly with the evolution of issues, and there does need to be a way to look at that. I know the concern has been how certain institutions would use that for recruiting and set up, you know, organize the businesses for athletes and really set that up so that some would benefit in significant ways. But, you know, as with everything, there's a way to try to figure it out if you can arrive at the right principle you're trying to achieve.
Do you think amateurism is under threat, Karen?
Well, I think it's been under threat for a long time. I think there's a chance for amateurism to exist in youth sports, but even today it's a stretch for that. But so I think at the NCAA level it's questionable.
Let me get, looks like Dave from Pleasantville, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. It just occurred to me, I could be wrong about this, but I think there's a model in Europe where people that are on a professional athletic career path go to a separate university that's specifically designed for that type of education. So I don't know if that's too radical a model to adopt here, but maybe the universities in question could break off a separate college for athletic studies and maybe have a different set of standards and rules.
Dave, let me see what Karen Weaver thinks about that.
Dave, I think that that's a great idea. And in a lot of ways, the Europeans have had a separate model for a long time. But the challenge for college sports now is the television dollars that come in. And there's a lot of revenue based on the fact that these are passionate student athletes who care about their sport, who represent their school, and have a very loud and boisterous following at some of these schools. So separating that out, television networks rightly wonder, will then the interest die off? I mean, how many people watch an NBA D-League game? And that's what some of these events might turn into, and where there's a few hundred people in the stands versus 100,000.
What do you think, Amy?
Well, I think, you know, America has a truly unique system in that we've always had sports integrated in our schools, in our universities. And that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. What the caller, you know, is referencing are some tracks that elite athletes are put into, and they may study and do more at their sport, but in terms of, you know, a university team, it doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. One of folks are speculating that, you know, one alternative, and certainly you can see how the current decisions and lawsuits may really evolve the model to this certain type of system, is whether or not we're looking at choices institutions will have to make about having really semi-professional teams that have that receive a license from the university to use their mark and their mascot, and really have no affiliation with the university other than the uniform they're wearing, and that is what, you know, Karen has referenced in her comments. And I think, you know, that's a model that folks really do not favor, but certainly it is a model that you could see as a potential evolution.
Karen, what do you see as, if there's a happy ending to this story, what would that look like?
Well, I think it's important that the student athletes get heard, and that's certainly what the Knight Commission and others are saying. And I think certainly this ruling has made folks sit up and take notice. But I also think it's important that we don't mask this issue with a pay-for-play model. This is really about health and safety, welfare, lifetime medical care for certain student athletes who get injured, the opportunity to complete their degrees in the areas that they wish to compete in. There are a number of other issues that aren't as sexy as pay-for-play, but they're just as valuable and as important to the student athletes.
But do you think that this decision is will be putting that kind of pressure on, if not the NCAA, then colleges and universities?
I think it's sparked an enormous dialogue in the last 2 weeks since this ruling comes down in a wide range, and everybody is aware of it. So I think it has raised it into the national consciousness.
Amy, I'm giving you the last word, about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye. What's a happy ending for you?
Well, again, as we've said, that, you know, changes are needed to restore integrity to an aspect of university life that is absolutely treasured by the American public. So we need to get back and put the emphasis where it needs to be on the educational mission, make sure the money is being directed toward that educational mission and treating athletes fairly and achieving better educational outcomes. And we can do that without unions as long as university leaders and college sports leaders are committed to that principle.
Amy Perko, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
You're welcome.
And she's the executive director of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics. Karen Weaver, thank you very much as well.
You are welcome.
And she's an associate clinical professor of sports management at Drexel University. And after this very short break, we'll be talking about the Mighty Max. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Inishnua Theater Company supports WHYY, dedicated to staging contemporary plays from Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales. Inishnua is currently presenting Midsummer, a play with songs by David Grieg and Gordon McIntyre, directed by Kate Galvin. On stage now through April 27th at the Off Broad Street Theater, 1636 Sampson Street. More information is online at tellthestory.us.
A reunion of centuries.
I didn't suspect that I had white cousins. I knew it.
My ancestors didn't see fit to write down the lives of those people.
Two women divided by the legacy of slavery reunited, reaching across color lines to find family. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
today at noon on WHYY.
Westtown School supports WHYY. Westtown invites families to their 650-acre campus for three spring events, an activity-filled celebration of science, and the opening of their new LEED Certified Science Center on Science Day, April 12th, a pre-K through 12 open house April 21st, and the Splash and Dash 5K Run and Youth Triathlon April 27th. Details for all three events at westtown.edu/april@westtown. Westtown School. Expect a life-size education.
This is Radio Times. Here on WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And now for a good news sports story. Immaculata College's famed Mighty Max basketball team was just named to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. The women's team won national championships 3 years in a row in 1972, 73, and 74. Denise Conway Crawford played for those teams, in fact, was the captain of the 74 team, and she joins us on Radio Times. And Denise Conway Crawford, congratulations and welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Were you surprised that the team was named?
We were totally surprised. We knew Kathy Rush was inducted in 2008, and we had a couple real stars on our team in Teresa Shank-Rentz and Marianne Crawford Stanley, and we suspected that at some point, you know, they would get in, but never did we really think that they would put us in as a team, so it's exciting.
That's great. And Kathy Rush, of course, the coach for your team and for this championship season. What made her such a good coach? And I know she was pretty young at the time.
Kathy was very young at the time. Kathy's only 4 or 5 years older than I am, and Kathy came to the school simply to, you know, work in a profession that she loved, and she got there with a lot of very good players who also got there kind of accidentally. None of us went to the school to play basketball. We all went to the school to be educated, and Kathy came in with a lot of good insight into how to play the game, and you know, we loved playing the game, and you know, it was like a perfect storm. You know, it's at the end of the day, we ended up with very successful teams, and, the rest is history.
Indeed it is. Well, certainly it is. She worked you pretty hard, too, right?
She did work us hard, but she certainly didn't work us the way these athletes are worked today. I was just listening to some of your conversation with Karen and Amy, and you know, the basketball world is very, very different than it was back in the 70s. Back, you know, we went to Immaculata, or at least I did, in 1970. And, you know, there were no college scholarships. Immaculata didn't even have a phys ed department. And, you know, the Title IX in 1972 changed a lot of the face of women's athletics. But, It was just a very special time.
So when did you start playing basketball?
I didn't start actually playing basketball till I was in seventh grade. I was about 12 years old and, you know, played for my little grade school team, but loved the game and went on and played at Archbishop Prendergast in Drexel Hill, and then thought at the end of my high school career that, you know, that was kind of the end of my competitive basketball days. And thought I was only going to Immaculata to play an intramural sports program. But it turned out to be much more than that. And 40-some years later, this is a story that just does not die.
No, there was a movie made about the Mighty Max just a couple of years ago. I think you and I are about the same age, and I remember playing high school basketball. And those were the days where you could dribble three times, or you were only allowed to dribble three times, and then you had to pass the ball.
That's correct.
And you had to stay on one side or the other of that middle line, except for, I think, a rover that could cross over the line.
Marty, you are about the same age that I am. And
it feels the really, truly the olden days.
Absolutely. So I graduated in 1970 and graduated from high school where that is exactly how we played. We had your guards who could be at one end and could shoot the ball. You had your forwards at the other end who could only defend. And then you had your rovers who were able to go back and forth on both ends, but only with three dribbles.
That's right.
So it was our freshman year at Immaculata that those rules changed to the five players and everyone being able to navigate the floor. And so we had to actually go in there and start playing a very different type of a game if you were not a rover, which I was. So, yeah, this a lot of things changed back in the 70s, which is why I think this is such an incredible story. I think people had no expectation that girls' basketball was anything at that point.
You mentioned Kathy Rush, your coach, but what do you think, as you look back on these 3 years and you played for those teams, 72, 73, 74, you were a captain of the 74 team, but what made you so good, do you think?
Well, I think we just really liked each other, and I think we played the game for the love of the game, and so nothing we did was work. Everything we did was because we wanted to do it, and you know, our whole life, our whole focus was not built around the basketball and the basketball court. That was only a piece of our lives at that point. And little did we know that that piece of our lives, 40-some years later, would still be, right, you know, have such an attraction to people. But I think it's because of the way it all started. And I think, you know, sometimes that's the sad part for the athletes today, is that it's more of a job for them. You know, they go in, they're paid big money to play this game. And I think, you know, many times it does take away the fun for them.
I was reading that one way that the Mighty Max raised money to play basketball was selling toothbrushes.
Correct. So
toothbrushes? Toothbrushes.
Well, yeah, toothbrushes, and we had some mugs out there that we were selling. And when we won the first championship, or we went to the regionals first and then were invited to the nationals because they took the first and second place teams, our college had no money to send us, and many of us didn't have money to take ourselves. Most of us were commuters at that time. So we could only take 8 of our players and a coach to that first championship. And in order to get there, we sold these toothbrushes, sold mugs, you know, begged, borrowed, and stole till we had what we needed to get out there. And then, to be very honest with you, we didn't know how we were getting back.
Really? You had to sell some more toothbrushes to get home?
Yeah, no, as it turned out, there was a nice benevolent donor who came forward and flew us back, first class, no less.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, because, you know, we're out there, we're little Immaculata College, nobody ever heard of us, we're seated 15th in the arena, and we would call back and say, you know, we won. And people would say, oh, that's cute. You know, that, we won't get that call again. And then you play the second game, and you call back and say we won. And third game and fourth game, and I think people just, you know, were totally, totally amazed that this was even a possibility. So,
well, we're talking about a little Immaculata College's famed Mighty Max basketball team. They won championships 3 years in a row, 72, 73, 74. Our guest Denise Conway Crawford played on all those teams and actually was the captain of the 74 team and the Mighty Max, just named to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. And if you want to give us a call and talk to Denise, or perhaps have some memories of some of those games, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. You were also the first women's basketball team to play in Madison Square Gardens. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do have that right. Now, I was not on that team. That actually was played in 1975.
Wow.
But that was, Immaculata was the first to be in Madison Square Garden, because I think, you know, at that point, that's where people were starting to realize that there could be some fun attached to watching some of these women's games. So they put it in a bigger arena, and it was a beautiful thing to watch.
And did you feel when you were playing that, at least as it got to 1974, that you were starting to make history, or you were making history?
I'm not sure if we really realized it was making history. We knew that it was, you know, obviously something people were talking about, people were enjoying, it was a big thing for the area. It was some of our sports teams at the time were not so terrific, and so Immaculata was a good feel-good story for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But as far as history, as far as thinking that 20, 30, 40 years down the line, people would still be saying what pioneers we were. I'm not sure if that was conscious to us. It's conscious today, but I'm not sure it was conscious then.
We have a comment actually from a guest who had joined us right before you came on the air with us, Denise, saying, can you ask Denise to talk about the nuns hitting the baskets with spoons?
They had buckets that they would hit with spoons. Rini Muse Portland, her father owned a hardware store, and so he would come to the games with buckets, metal buckets from his store, and then people would bang on these buckets in a cheering, playful way to let us know that, you know, our contingent was in the stands supporting us.
Wow.
So they have pictures, you know, on many websites of the sisters out there in the stands banging on these buckets. Those sisters were such wonderful supporters, which, again, you know, was a beautiful thing.
Sure.
We had, you know, our educators giving us a tremendous education and yet, you know, being with us when we were playing a sport that we loved.
And would the sisters ever go on the court and toss a ball around?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, the sisters were great. You know, they liked to think that we had activities outside of the classroom. And the more successful the basketball team was getting, the more exciting it was becoming to them, too. And sure, they'd come out and we'd have some faculty games. And yeah, we had a lot of fun with them. They were very, very good people.
And who was your big rival back in the days, back in the early 70s?
Well, we went to the nationals for the first time, to the regionals in 1972. And we, in the final game, played Westchester and lost to them by about 38 points.
Wow.
But the first and second place teams were invited to the nationals. So it really did not make a lot of difference whether we came in first or second, won or lost. Then when we got to the nationals, the final game ended up being against Westchester again, believe it or not, both of us from the same areas.
Yep.
And we were fortunate enough to come away that time with a 4-point win, and that just started the whole thing rolling.
Let me get Mike from Woodstown, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Hi, thank you. Listen, I especially want to thank you today for doing this program because I had forgotten all about the Mighty Max, and I wanted to compliment and thank your guest as well, because at that time I was attending an all-male Jesuit prep school, high school, and I'll tell you, all of the guys supported that team because they represented, of course, us Catholics, and we were very, very proud of them. So I just wanted to thank your guest for those great memories.
Oh, that's great. Mike, where did you go to high school?
I went to Bishop Eustace Prep in Pensauken, in Jersey.
Rooting for the Mighty Max.
It was all male at the time, yeah.
Denise, you want to comment on Mike's comment?
You know what, Mike? Thanks so much. We appreciate the fact that you were such a supporter. We had many, many wonderful supporters back in the day. We actually had Mary Scharf played on our team. She was a freshman when I was a senior. She went to Paul VI over in Jersey. And it just, you know, what you're saying just speaks to, I think, what Marty and I are talking about, that now, this was a story that was very far-reaching to people for whatever reason. I mean, you think about a game that you just play for the love of playing, and it's had some quite an impact on an awful lot of people and an awful lot of people's lives, whether they were players or not. So it's nice to hear that, Mike. Thanks very much.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I've seen pictures of your uniforms back in the 70s. Can you describe them to our listeners?
Our uniforms, we had little bloomers under little tunics, and we had only one uniform, and some of our uniforms didn't even match. Our numbers, some were bigger, some were smaller. I commented the other day, I was talking to Jeff Skaversky from Channel 6 and telling him that the first time they came out to do any kind of publicity after we won in 1972, at that time we could not wear pants to school.
Uh-huh.
We had to wear skirts. And so when they came out to do any kind of an interview at that point, we didn't have, you know, matching uniforms. We weren't dressed like athletes. We literally threw on some mismatched jackets and had our pictures taken in stockings and dress shoes, looking like certainly not like athletes. We didn't have much. The one uniform we had, we took it with us. We washed it.
Made it work.
We wore it the next day. We just made it work.
When you look at basketball today, and I'm assuming you watch women's basketball.
Oh, my gosh. Love it. Yep.
And love it, clearly. I mean, what do you see as the most dramatic difference between how you played basketball and how basketball is being played today?
Well, you know what? It's obviously a much more physical game, and where we didn't really do any kind of training, these athletes are, you know, in the weight rooms all the time, and, you know, they're much stronger, they're much faster. You know, on our team, you know, Teresa Grantz and Marianne Stanley were pretty much ahead of their time when it came to being basketball players, you know, and but the rest of us, I would say, if we had to play today, I'm not sure we'd keep up. You know, these girls just, they play at a much faster, higher level than we were at that time.
And did you continue to play just recreationally after you graduated from Immaculata?
I did. I taught at Ridley High School when I got out of Immaculata, and I coached there for a while, and, you know, we would just play a lot of pickup games and things. At that point, we didn't play anything competitive. But, yeah, it was just fun to keep your hand in it.
Well, Denise Conway Crawford, it's been fun to talk to you, and thank you so much, and congratulations as well.
Thank you, Marty. Thanks for having me. I appreciate all this.
Oh, absolutely. Well, this is, as I said, it's a good news story, and that's Immaculata's famed Mighty Max basketball team, just named to the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame. The team won championships 3 years in a row, 72, 73, 74, and our guest Denise Conway Crawford played on those teams and was the captain of the 74 team. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.